Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
This week's episode of A Cast of Kings is brought to you by Hover.com. When you have a great idea, you want to secure a great domain name for it, find a perfect name that represents your project by going to hover.com/fire. This week, our promo code is hover.com/fire. John Robinson, the title of this week's episode is Fire and Blood. And this is a line that Maester Pycelle says during the episode, I believe. He says something along the lines of how the Mad King was consumed by visions of fire and blood. But any thoughts as to why this episode is named Fire and Blood?
I believe that those are the House Targaryen words. And also, you know, I guess it starts with the dripping of the blood off the sword.
Mm-hmm.
And ends with fire and Daenerys.
Very good. Yeah, the circle is complete. Go to hover.com/fire and get 10% off your first purchase. Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen.
I'm Joanna Robinson.
And together we're reading Book 1 from George R.R. Martin's The Song of Ice and Fire, entitled A Game of Thrones. Find more episodes of this podcast at gameofthronespodcast.com, and you can also email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Find us also on Facebook at facebook.com/acastofkings, where you can comment on every week's episode. And we are at the end, John Robinson. We have reached the end of our Season 1 rewatch and book club. And we hope people listening have enjoyed this season. And we hope to be back next season as well. Hope you guys who tuned in are able to patronize our sponsors. They'll keep us coming back to this podcast indefinitely. Yeah, John, it's been quite a ride. This week we're going to be talking about Season 1, Episode 10, entitled Fire and Blood. And we will be spoiling everything through the show, but we will not be spoiling anything that's in the books that hasn't been covered on the HBO show yet. And we'll also be talking about everything through the first book of A Song of Ice and Fire. So That's what we're going to be doing today on A Cast of Kings. This episode was directed by Alan Taylor, who I think we've sung his praises before as a talented Game of Thrones director. And it's written by Benioff and Weiss, who wrote the vast majority of episodes this season.
Yeah.
Which I don't think it continues quite at the same pace in later seasons.
Definitely not. They bring on far more writers to sort of lighten the load as the scope of Game of Thrones gets bigger and bigger.
Definitely. This is, you know, as good as Baelor was in as an episode, I feel like this episode was also a great achievement in, you know, the history of television. And we'll get into why exactly in a bit. But I guess let's just dive. Oh, actually, before we begin, Joanna, do we have any feedback we want to talk about? I forgot to ask.
I do want to talk about one comment we received, mostly because this person went to the trouble of writing the same exact comment twice. So I'm going to give him this is from Luca over on the Facebook page. And it's, we keep talking about how the baby, Cersei and Robert's baby, has been retconned out of existence. And Luca wrote this comment at least twice. I might have seen it three times. He's been pretty persistent that we get this message, so I'm going to read it. He says, Cersei's dead infant with Robert wasn't retconned out of existence. In those days, you would never count a dead baby as one of your kids since the mortality rate was horrifically high. In her prophecy, Maggie the Frog names the only three kids that mattered, those who survived infancy. Just as in A Feast for Crows, Maggie naturally didn't mention Robert's aborted son from A Game of Thrones in season 5. She didn't mention the first season's dead baby. In that society, those were equivalent. When writing the flashbacks, Weiss and Benioff had two options: being faithful to the lines in the book, thus not mentioning their invented baby, who had to be ignored if they wanted to abide by customs of that medieval-like society. Though it would mean they would confuse a few Among Us fans who remember the dead baby but aren't unaware of the fact that dead infants weren't ever taken into account. Or changing the lines, thus angering book fans and also introducing an all-too-modern perspective on children, just to not confuse those of us who remember the black-haired baby but don't know it doesn't make sense to mention him. I think they made the right choice, not only for most of the audience, but for the consistency of their world. Brian Cogman, friend of the show, confirmed this. And this is a Brian Cogman quote. Maggie's just speaking of the three official kids who lived and were known, etc. The black-haired baby was kept quiet. Look the quote up on Watchers on the Wall in this article in particular. There's a link over on our Facebook page to Watchers on the Wall interview with Brian or quote from Brian Cogman. I'm not sure that addresses precisely our concerns, but Luca is sure they are.
Luca's argument essentially boils down to, well, of course the prophecy woman wouldn't have included people in her dead babies in her prophecy, I think is what, or children that died, because to her, those would have been the same as children, no children at all.
I guess so.
Which I think is a bit of a stretch, but, you know, to each his own, I think we can say. So, and really, that is what this season of A Cast of Kings has been about, is picking over this, like, tiny minutia in the show.
Welcome to the world of book readers.
Yes, exactly. Well, why don't we talk briefly about that, actually, before we get to this episode, which is what has been my experience reading the book along with you. And I will just say this, that reading the book along with you this season has given me an enormous appreciation for what you do for the podcast every single week, simply because it takes usually more than an hour, usually hours. And there's all this detail in there that I basically ask you to call up, you know, in an instant on the actual podcast. And you do a pretty good job most of the time. So I just think it's extraordinarily difficult what you've been able to do. And now having gone through the book reading gauntlet, I have an even greater appreciation of it.
So, thank you. We both know that I mess up fairly regularly.
I don't recall you ever making a mistake, but okay.
But that's half the joy of this podcast.
Yes.
Is telling me when I'm wrong. But what I will say is that over the seasons of working with you, I've come to a place where I start to anticipate what questions you're going to ask me and make sure to do research. I'm not always bang on, but I'm really proud of myself when I'm like, he asked the question I thought he was going to ask.
So, very good.
Anyway.
I think the only other thing I would say is that this whole season has given me a greater appreciation for both the book and the show. Just reading the book, you see all the detail, all the backstory that was put in there that didn't make it into the show. And then rewatching the show, you see all the ways they adapted it to make it more efficient, to make it more powerful. And, you know, we're going to talk about some of those elements this episode. Overall, I for me personally, it was a very worthwhile experience, and I hope that at least some of that translated for our listeners. So, any other thoughts about this rewatch and book club for season one, Jonah Robinson?
No, it's been really fun.
Yes.
Absolutely. A lot of work, but really fun. Yeah.
Indeed, indeed. All right, well, let's get into this week's episode. So this episode entitled Fire and Blood, we begin moments after last week's episode, blood dripping off the blade. I always thought when I saw this scene that that was just like a lot of blood to be dripping off for a beheading. But I've never been to a beheading, so... I have no idea how accurate it is. But felt to me like it was a clean death, and therefore maybe there wouldn't be that much blood. But whatever, maybe the blade, you know, he left the blade under Ned's neck and underbody, and it just got a ton of blood all over it. But it was a lot of blood, very thick, flowing blood, to emphasize for you that there's no mistake that Ned is dead.
Viscous, I think, is
very good.
And then we see Ned's beheaded body as
yeah,
well.
That too. Sansa passes out, which who wouldn't? And then Jorin takes Arya away, and they're off. And you know, like we talked last week about how that chapter ended with Jorin grabbing Arya's hair, and this week we find out that he's cutting her hair, and he's gonna make her look like a boy so that people won't even suspect that she's Arya Stark. Anything you want to comment on in this opening scene?
Well, it's funny. We talked last week about that cliffhanger, you know, in the context of cliffhangers in the book. And in the reading that we did this week, you'll notice there's no Arya chapter at all. That stuff with, like, Hot Pie and Gendry, I think, that we'll get to later in the episode, is in the next book. So that's actually a cliffhanger for Arya for the entire book. What's going to happen to Arya? There's a blade coming at her face. That's the last thing we hear, right? So... imagine having to wait until the next book comes out to find out.
Well, Pat Sponigal, a great reader of the book and listener to the podcast, wrote in at the Facebook page because I made a remark last week about how the show doesn't really do people getting saved at the last moment very much, right? That the show and the book will often instead subvert your expectations in that regard. And Pat wrote in, Dave's comment on Ned not being saved at the last minute and how the show doesn't do those isn't quite right. Ned wasn't saved, but the show still provides moments of peril with rescues at the last moment. For instance, the Hound saves Sansa from rioters. Podrick saves Tyrion from Sir Mandon Moor. Those are two big cavalry moments. The combined Lannister-Tyrell cavalry breaking the siege on King's Landing and Stannis' army routing the Free Folk. Grey Worm is saved by Ser Barristan's heroism. Drogon gets Dany out with a fire with Dragonfire. And Ser Jaime leaps into a pit to save Brienne, armed only with his je ne sais quoi and his sexy charisma. So let's not dismiss those saves. Oh, and also that time that Theon was about to suffer some serious abuse by Bolton soldiers, but he was saved by the nice kid with the bow. So fair point. Those are pretty good saves. And Pat once again proves that I have no idea what I'm talking about. There were a bunch of saves. I will say, okay, that while Pat is absolutely right, we can agree that the show occasionally, if not often, subverts our expectations around who's the hero, who's the villain, and who's going to live and who's going to die.
Like Oberyn. You know, you think that maybe that Oberyn's going to win that fight against the Mountain, and then he doesn't.
You think that Robb and Kat are going to not die horribly for existence, and they do.
Right.
You know, yes. So I would say, yeah.
You think surely that little Shireen kid is not going to get burned at the stake.
was that is a show invention? Is that correct?
Yeah, so far it might be that Shireen gets killed in the future. Books. We're not sure.
Gotcha. All right. So King's Landing. And then not only do you get the scene of Arya and Jorin at the beginning, but you also see kind of where they're headed and meet Hot Pie and Gendry later on this episode, right?
Yes. And she walks by the cart where Jaqen H'ghar is, but they hadn't cast Jaqen H'ghar yet. So it's just some guy under a really big hood.
A really big hood. I was like, wow, can that guy see anything? So very good. Thank you for pointing that out, Joanna. Yeah. All right. So anything you want to say about that?
Just that Yoren ends with winter is coming and then off they go to the wall. It was a pretty good exit for Yoren this season. So
yeah. He's pretty awesome. It made me remember a time when Gendry was still a character in the show.
I miss you, Gendry.
Yeah. Last we heard, he was paddling off into the distance on a boat, correct?
Yes. Yeah. Still rowing. Yes.
Still rowing.
Also, a shout-out appreciation for Maisie Williams' terrible wig in this episode with that awful haircut that Yoren gave her. So, yeah.
Man, you just cannot let go of the wigs, General.
No, it's intentionally terrible.
How would
her
you feel?
Supposed to look bad.
How would you feel if she said that was her real hair, Joanna? How would you feel? Then you'd feel pretty bad, wouldn't you?
I would know that it's not.
All right. So what else happens in this scene? We get a scene in Winterfell with Bran having a dream, and he goes down to the crypt with Asha, and Rickon's wolf attacks them, and he Rickon had a dream about Ned, and it was a bad one, and that's when Maester Luwin tells Bran, hey, your father's dead. This scene seemed like it was meant to, if not do some exposition, then remind us of exposition that already happened around who Lyanna was, for instance. What did you get out of this scene?
Yeah, I mean, it's in the books. This reminder of who's in the Winterfell crypts, this sort of instance of Rickon and Bran having the same dream of Ned being down in the crypt, of the adults telling them, no, it's fine, your dad's fine, and then finding out that he's not. Bran, we know, has visions. It's really interesting. Someone pointed out to me recently that Rickon is often right about things. Like in the beginning of the season, you know, when when Bran's like, Mom and Dad are coming back, and Rickon's like, nope, they're never coming back. And he was right. You know, and Rickon has the same prophetic dream that Bran had about Ned being down in the crypt. So we haven't really explored anything about Rickon in the show at all, really. But what if he also has some sort of gift? I don't know. We'll find out.
A lot of untapped power there, for sure. Speaking of people who may or may not have gifts, one of the issues brought up in last week's podcast was whether or not Jon Snow is a Targaryen, because if he was a Targaryen, he wouldn't have been burned by the Lantern from the previous week's episode, right? But then people on the Facebook page at facebook.com/acastofkings rightfully pointed out, well, if Viserys is a Targaryen, you know, why was he burned by this melting gold all over his face? Did you ever have a way of squaring that in your head?
I've talked about this in the podcast before, that I don't think it's clear what the rules are.
Right.
In terms of fire and Targaryens. That Daenerys apparently survived the fire, like, at the end of this episode, not just because she's a Targaryen, but because, you know, she did some blood magic, basically a life for a life, or that sort of stuff. I just don't know what the rules are, to be perfectly honest with you. And the way Daenerys squares it is she thinks Viserys is not a dragon, but it's not because he's not a blood Targaryen, right. Just he doesn't have the right spirit to be a dragon. Yeah. And she does, because she likes her baths very hot.
And that's the only reason. Yep.
I mean, I don't know, man. I don't know. It's all kind of a mystery to me. And in my opinion, George R. R. Martin, I mean, I know you guys are all going to write in with your opinions, and that's great. And I can't wait to read them. But in my opinion, George R. R. Martin has not explained this satisfactorily. But it's nitpicky. It doesn't really matter.
So this episode, we see all the Starks getting the news of Ned's death and how they deal with it in different ways. At the Stark camp, Catelyn and Robb gets the news. Catelyn kind of leaves the camp and kind of how would you describe that motion that she does? I guess
like swoons against a tree,
right? Just like nausea sweeps over you, like dizziness. Your whole life is becoming unmoored. I think she does a great job, and she's still kind of overwhelmed by emotion until she sees Rob himself just hacking away at a tree in anger. And it's a very touching moment that's punctuated also by their mutual desire to quote-unquote kill them all, which was one of the most memorable moments from the first season for me, just the way the camera kind of swoops around them while they're embracing and vowing to get their sisters back, Rob's sisters back, and then vowing to kill all the Lannisters. And man, was I right there with them the first time I saw this episode.
And they never do.
So
yeah, it's rough watching that scene going, yeah, we're going to kill them. We're going to kill them all. We're going to get our revenge. And as you say about subverting expectations, the expectation is, oh, yeah, I've seen this movie. This is Gladiator. This is whatever. They killed their family. Now they're going to get their revenge and triumph in a way, you know, in right. some way. But no.
Rob! You've ruined your sword.
I'll kill them all. Every one of them. I'm gonna kill them all.
Sisters, we have to get the girls back, and then we will kill them all.
What's really cool about this episode is the one thing I was struck with rewatching the episode is how much of the stuff that happens in this episode becomes ironic later on, right? That knowing what happens in this episode, knowing what happens later on. Wow, a lot of the stuff that happens in this episode is ironic the correct word? I guess it just makes later developments seem especially unexpected. And I'll go into that a little bit. But one of them is this, you know, that they're going to kill them all. And like you said, it's kind of invoking these common tropes from these sword and sandal movies or medieval films. And we already know that it's not going to work out for them. It's not even not going to work out for them. It's going to be the opposite of working out for them, you know? It's the Lannisters who are going to triumph here. So
for now.
For now. There is a scene in the Stark camp. Actually, all this in the book takes place at Lord Hoster's?
Lord Hoster Tully.
Lord Hoster Tully's...
River Run.
River Run, right. And so there's this great hall that they meet in, and we meet Edmure here, which doesn't happen in the show until later on. So right. There's a bunch of stuff going on here. And also Lord Hoster Tully himself, right? Like
right.
Catelyn's father, who's just like excised completely from the show.
Right.
Are any of these characters, just out of curiosity, are any of these characters those who you felt like, oh man, I really wish they'd included that character in the show?
I think Brendan Blackfish Tully is a character that a lot of book readers are sad. Like he's pretty good in the show, you know, he shows up, he's pretty good, but he's kind of great in the book, and they haven't quite nailed it.
Gotcha.
But he's not dead, so they still have time.
At least he's not. At least he doesn't get sand snakes treatment, right?
So true.
So they are meeting in the Stark camp, and they're kind of talking about what they should do. You know, should we unite behind Renly or Stannis? And then I think, is it Karstark who pledges fealty to Rob? Like first?
Great John Umber, I believe.
Great John Umber. Is he or is he not the guy who's later beheaded?
No, that's Karstark.
That's Karstark. Okay. All right. Well, anyway, Great John Umber. And then actually in the book, Karstark as well pledges fealty, followed by Theon, which is not in the book. But this is another thing where that like because they put that in there, it makes Theon's eventual betrayal all the more biting, right?
Yeah.
But that is an amazing scene in the show, and you really get kind of riled up. It is genuinely moving that all these people are willing to unite behind this guy who looks like he's in his early 20s in the show, right?
Right. These grizzled men in their beards are kneeling down to him and shouting, "King in the North, King in the North." It's very moving.
Yeah, it is a great – and it's a great line too, the King in the North. And the show has a great skill. And, you know, George R. R. Martin has great skill for, like, writing these incredibly memorable lines.
Right, because King of the North just doesn't have the same ring to it as King in the North.
Yes.
For whatever reason, you know.
For some whatever reason. He knows exactly how to arrange the syllables.
The proper course is clear. Pledge fealty to King Renly and move south to join our forces with his.
Renly is not the king.
You cannot mean to hold to Joffrey, my lord. He put your father to death.
And doesn't make Renly king. He's Robert's youngest brother. A Bran can't be Lord of Winterfell before me. Renly can't be king before Stannis.
Do you mean to declare us for Stannis?
Renly is not right.
My lords. My lords. Here is what I say to these two kings. Renly Baratheon is nothing to me. Nor Stannis neither. Why should they rule over me and mine from some flowery seat in the south? What do they know of the war or the wolf's wood? Even their gods are wrong. Why shouldn't we rule ourselves again? It was the dragons we bowed to. And now the dragons are dead. There sits the only king I mean to bend my knee to. The King of the North!
Catelyn visits Jaime, which, by the way, even at this early stage, I could already sense that the security around Jaime was not quite as high as it should have been. And you knew they were going to pay.
He's not even in a cage at this point.
He's not even in a cage.
To a wall.
You know, Catelyn says, "Leave us." And the guy's just like, "Okay." You know, and he just leaves her. And that is probably what ends up happening later on. And it would be a really strategic error for them to leave her.
At least later, he's in a cage.
In a cage, Joanna, this is like, you got to, like, suicide watch is not – well, yeah, you got to put him on suicide watch and or mischief watch. You know? You don't want him killing his own family members, for instance.
Yeah, I was about to say mischief for Jaime Lannister is bludgeoning his own cousin to death. Yeah. Yeah, and this isn't in the book, but it's a really good scene, I think.
Great exchange here between Catelyn and Jaime, and it plays out exactly as I would think that conversation plays out, because at this point, Catelyn still doesn't know – why Bran was pushed out the tree, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or the tower, yeah. Like that he saw them having sex and, you know, he's having sex with his sister. Maybe she suspects that, like, I forget, like, does she know that Joffrey is not the true heir at this point? I don't think so, right?
No.
Yeah, so, and then what is Jaime going to say? Like, he's obviously not going to tell her the truth. Do you? It feels to me like maybe he's a little bit embarrassed. I don't know. That's my projection onto his performance here.
I feel like the way Nicola Costa-Waldau was playing it, he almost told her the truth. Like, he thought about it.
Right.
It looked like he thought about telling her the truth. Or even something like, he saw something he shouldn't have seen. You know, I was expecting those words to come out of his mouth, but he just didn't say anything. I really like the line, I think she says something like, "Men like you," and he said, "There are no men like me, there's only me," which is a great line.
Right.
And then they talk about justice, the nature of justice, and it's all really fascinating and completely show-invented.
Yeah, and I think it sets up well the developments in the show that happen later on, you know, with Brienne and Catelyn breaking Jaime out, basically. I think this makes that development slightly more understandable.
Yeah.
At the very least, is a nice prelude to that.
A lot of this episode is building for next season, right?
Yeah.
Basically setting the stage for the War of the Five Kings. Setting up Stannis and Renly as credible threats. Rob as a king that's a threat. Setting it all up. So
there is a moment in the book that's not in the show at all that I actually thought was kind of nice, which is when Kat meets up with all of her family members and they're talking about strategically what's going on, she has a moment of deep regret over having seized Tyrion. And that basically never happens in the show, right? Like, I don't think she ever has any regret over her fairly silly actions this season.
She also counsels peace. She's like, let's make peace, trade our Lannisters for Starks, and go home.
Right, because she doesn't want to see her children all die in war.
Right, which is very different from, we'll kill them all, right?
Yeah, you know, tomato, tomato.
So yeah, Catelyn of the book is like trying to be like, let's make peace with Joffrey, get my daughters back. I want to go back to Winterfell. Rob can be Lord of Winterfell. The end. And then all the Lords of the North are like, nope, not good enough. No, thank you. So
she makes much smarter choices in the book, for sure, I think, or at least is much smarter. And you know what else is much smarter, Joanna, than normal domain registrars? Hover.com.
Oh.
Which is an awesome domain registrar. If, let's say you guys listen to this podcast, you have some idea, you want to start a business, you want to start a blog, you want to start a podcast. Well, hover.com/fire is a great way to get that idea off the ground because it is a great way to get a domain name quickly and cheaply and with a ton of features that you have to pay for on other services. Hover takes all the hassle and confusion out of buying and managing your domain. In less than 5 minutes, you can get the domain name you want and get it up and running. Hover.com is also super clean and simple, so you don't have to mess around with a complicated interface. Jonah Robinson, have you ever registered a domain name at a place that's not Hover.com?
I sure have, Dave Chen.
It's probably a huge pain in the ass.
It really is. Actually,
You have to click through like 15 screens and go through all this rigmarole just to get a domain name you want. And they make it super complicated by selling you stuff that you don't want. They make you pay the upgrade for features that should come for free. Hover.com doesn't believe in any heavy-handed upselling. They include everything you need with your domain, including a free valet transfer service so you can skip the hassle of moving your domains over to Hover from where they're currently registered. So let's say you do have your domains registered at blank, which I can't name because why would I during an ad for Hover.com? They have a free domain valet transfer service. So you can just get all your stuff on the Hover, manage it all from there, and it's a great service. So go to hover.com/fire and get 10% off your first purchase. And we'd really appreciate if you guys went there and bought a domain because Hover is a huge backer of A Cast of Kings. If you've enjoyed anything that we've done this season, we're not asking you to donate. We're not asking you to kickstart us. Just go to hover.com/fire and buy a domain name. Who knows? It could become a multi-million dollar idea for you. So thanks a lot for Hover to sponsoring us this season. Thanks also to all of our other sponsors as well. It's been quite a fun ride. We really appreciate them sticking with us for this season one rewatch and book club. Let's move on, Jonah Robinson, to what else has been going on this season, or this episode, I should say. King's Landing. We begin there in the throne room. There is this guy singing a song about Robert Baratheon's death, right?
Right, right.
And I was actually surprised that this song wasn't in the book. It's the lyrics to the song are, let's be honest, quite offensive. Having
phenomenal,
they're very very bad. And so there's this question of like, why is he even singing this song? Because the way it's set up, it almost seems like he's kind of entertaining Joffrey. But in fact, he's been brought in front of Joffrey at Joffrey's request, right? Joffrey is demanding someone sang this offensive song. I think the closing line is something like, the lion took his, referring to Robert, the lion took his balls off the board and all the rest. I think that's the closing lines. Lion being Cersei Lannister.
Right.
Because that's her house sigil, right?
Mm-hmm.
So very, very, it's like very insulting to both Robert and Cersei. I was curious, like, what is the backstory? Why is this guy singing this song here? they hint at it in the show, and in the book they make it very explicit that, yeah, Joffrey had heard about it and basically brought the guy here and forced him to sing the song, even though the guy promised he wouldn't sing the song. If I were the guy, I probably would have just changed the lyrics like on the fly, Eminem style. You know what I mean? Like, don't even go near where people thought it was. What did you think of the song?
I thought it was great.
Yeah. It's pretty rough.
But it's great. I mean, Cersei murdered Robert, basically. So I'm not like too precious about.
I didn't know that. Like, that was such a common perception that it had filtered down to the common folk, and then people are actually writing songs about it, right?
Well, I mean, it's more like, isn't he just talking about how Cersei is a man-eater and a controlling wife and all this sort of stuff? And I don't know that it's explicitly about her murdering Robert.
Mm. Yeah.
Anyway,
great. But even that, like, I'm just surprised that people are aware of the marital dynamics. You know, maybe that's why it wasn't in the book, because there's no plausible way to make that happen. But in any case, great line. My favorite part of this whole scene, Joanna, aside from the fact that they order this guy's tongue get cut off, and that whole thing is shot very artistically with Sansa and the Hound in the foreground, and then, you know, them out of focus in the background, so you don't get to see how brutal and bloody it is, truly. But you hear it.
You hear the screaming.
You hear it.
Yeah.
My favorite part watching this episode and seeing the scene once more was that when Joffrey sentences this guy to get his tongue ripped out, I think it's Meryn Trant that does it, right?
I think it's Ilyn Payne.
Ilyn Payne, sorry. My bad. Is it Meryn Trant that hits? Yeah. Meryn Trant slaps Sansa later on.
Yes.
Ilyn Payne carries it out, and he already has his own tongue cut out. And so Joffrey says, what better person to carry out the sentence? And I love that Ilyn Payne has tongue tongs on his person already, as though this is a sentence that apparently gets carried out repeatedly during the course of a day. Like, if you see him, he just whips out these tongs, like he's ready to go. He has a dagger and the tongs just rearing to go. So Joffrey is a pretty brutal ruler. Anyway.
Did you interpret Cersei's look the same way I did, where she's like, I'm not sure he's doing a very good job being a ruler? I made a big mistake.
I think that's definitely part of it. But at the same time, I don't think she's like super displeased that this guy got his tongue cut off. You know, because
she's not upset about the guy. She's just like, Joffrey's just being such a little, he's just not being kingly at all.
Right.
He's being a smarmy little tool bag. And she's like, oh dear, this is our king? Oh no.
Right.
That's sort of my sense of what's going on in Leta Hedy's face. But
yeah, I mean, it's certainly what's going on in the books. I don't know that I got enough in the show to make that conclusion. Certainly, I think the events of last week's episode would have given you enough to make that conclusion. But yeah, I think that dynamic is a little bit missing. And we'll talk a little bit about that more later on. So they bring Sansa out to look at Ned's head. And if you didn't hate Joffrey enough, this is the scene, I think, that really cemented him as a villain character. A villain. Like, it's one thing if he actually thought he was doing the right thing, you know, by beheading. Like, let me put this out there, okay? I could actually see someone coming to the conclusion that killing Ned was actually that there's some value in doing that, like, because it sets up like that, you know, we will not tolerate these kinds of crimes, right? Like, tactically it's a horrible move, but maybe there's some kind of animating principle behind it. But I think this is the scene that just, like, there's just no justification for this level of cruelty. Maybe you're already there, Joanna, but for me, this is what tipped me over the edge.
Oh, okay. So, you're like, Ned's head. All right.
Yeah, that was okay. Mm-hmm. And do you recall the whole George W. Bush head controversy back in season 1 of Game of Thrones?
The George Bush head? Yeah.
Yeah. That originally, when this show was broadcast, there was a head fashioned after George W. Bush. I think, I'm not certain But I think you can see part of it maybe still in this.
You can see the profile.
Right.
And so Weiss and Benninghoff said in the commentary track, it's not a choice. It's not a political statement. It's just we had to use what heads we had lying around.
So there's a shot when they look up at Septa Mordain's head that you see a George W. Bush head. But he has like a lot of hair. It doesn't even look like him, you know. But it did remind me of that controversy.
HBO had to issue a statement saying we were deeply dismayed to see this and find it unacceptable, disrespectful, and in very bad taste. We made this clear to the executive producer of the series, who apologized immediately for this inadvertent, careless mistake. We are so sorry this happened, and we'll have it removed from any future DVD production.
Yeah. Man, we were so young back then, Joanna. We were so innocent back then.
It feels like weirdly pearl clutching. I'm like, I don't know.
George W. Bush head took place during a time when, you know, barely being able to make out a profile of George W. Bush with a ton of hair on this television show was one of the biggest problems we had in popular culture and politics at the time. So. Right. We are now in a different world. We're through the looking glass now, Joanna.
Sure are.
A lot of great moments during this scene. Obviously, very unpleasant to see Sansa subjected to this. I think my favorite line from the episode is when she says, "I promise I won't do any treason."
Treasons. Treasons, like plural, and it's from the book too.
Let me go home. You know, I won't do any treasons.
I won't do any treasons. It is a great line.
But you see her learning and adapting to the situation right quick, you know, when she says, how long, like, do you want me to keep looking, you know, as long as it pleases me. And she, you know, she starts, like, learning the things to say to not get beat, basically.
Yeah. And the Hound is there sort of trying to help her, you know, in his way. And there's that part where she is contemplating pushing him off. Yeah, and the Hound stops her. Not really necessarily to protect Joffrey, I think, but because he knows that she would be immediately killed. So.
Right. Either if she went down with him or because she killed him.
Right. Meryn Trant immediately would murder her.
So. Now, here's the thing is, like, would things have turned out better for the kingdom if she had killed him at this point? You know, I don't know. Like, it would have thrown the whole realm into chaos, probably, right?
Who would have been on the throne? Tommen, I guess.
Yeah. Tommen would have taken over even earlier.
Tommen would have been, like, a toddler king.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then it would have been easier, I think, for Tyrion to control things.
What I'm trying to say is Sansa not doing this costs thousands of people their lives.
This is like, would you go back in time and kill baby Hitler?
Yes.
Yes.
Would you go back in time and kill teenage Joffrey?
Oh, yes.
I think the answer is yes, right?
Yes.
We agree that Sansa made a grave mistake. This reminds me of this sketch that College Humor did about, like, man, wouldn't it be great to go back to the 90s and people miss, like, Pogs and 90s television shows and all this stuff. And then once they go back, the person who, like, takes him back with him to time travel says, you know, like, once we're done enjoying all this 90s stuff, you know what you have to do, right? You have to prevent 9/11 because you're the only person that knows about it. And how difficult that would be without actually endangering yourself. Sometimes you have a chance. This felt like a consequential moment in the history of Westeros that Sansa did not seize the opportunity for. So that is unfortunate. Can't say I blame her, though. Anything else we want to say about this scene?
Great job by Sophie Turner.
Yeah.
And Jack Gleeson as ever.
Yeah, he's so
perfect
good.
Little monster.
Yep, agreed. All right, what else happens? We have one other scene in King's Landing happens, which is we get a scene of Lancel and Cersei together. So not only do we find out that Cersei is having sex with Lancel, but also because they're sort of having this liaison, that possibly Lancel was involved with the death of Robert as well, right? Mm-hmm. This is kind of one of our big hints that was happening. And this would be a very consequential scene, because they would pay this off four seasons later in the most recent season, right? So,
did you know it was Lance? I forgot. I was like, who is that naked person behind that gauzy veil? I was like, is that
even after the entire last season, like the season five of the show that we watched together, Joanna?
Well, I didn't realize you were in Cersei's chamber. I was like, where are we? Oh, we're not at the Roz scene yet. Who's naked? And then Lancel has such like a slim little figure and long, beautiful hair. And I was like, is that a lady? He was hunched over. I couldn't tell. And then I was like, and then I saw Cersei. I was like, oh, it's Lancel. That's right.
Fair enough. Speaking of sex position and naked people going on like in the background while there's exposition, there's a scene with Maester Pycelle and Roz.
My fave, Roz, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, here's an example where the nudity is just crucial to what's going on in this scene, right? I mean, I think
absolutely.
We can say that without the nudity, like, the scene just would not have worked.
Not at all, no.
I actually might be right in that statement, but not in the way not in the way that we thought about just now. So
are you talking about Pycelle's nudity? Or, like, the fact that we can see right through his shift?
His shift? Is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm.
I was not talking about Pycelle's nudity, in fact. But years later, I'm still kind of puzzling over what the purpose of the scene was. I think it shows us that Pycelle is an incredibly deceptive character because, you know, you see that he's flexible and then you see him, like, purposefully, like, hunch over and walk slowly before he leaves the room.
Right.
This is all an act. It reminds me of that scene in The Prestige. I think I might have brought this up years ago when we first talked about the scene. But there's a scene in The Prestige where they go to see an old magician. And this magician can make like a goldfish bowl appear out of nowhere. And the two magicians are talking to each other and they say, like, this part where he's like slowly walking to his carriage, like, this is the act. Do you know? Not the bringing the goldfish bowl up. It's this part where the rest of the time he pretends to be this incredibly old person. And people underestimate him because he's weak.
Hmm.
Any thoughts on this scene and why it was included?
I think because we get that Varys and Littlefinger scene later. And I don't know, you know, we've talked before about these two-hander scenes that were show inventions. I don't know if that's why the Roz and Pycelle scene is there, why the Littlefinger and Varys scene is there, maybe even why the Jaime and Catelyn scenes are there. But
just wanted to fill space, I guess.
No, that's one option. But the other thing is to say that when you put Pycelle and Roz back to back with Varys and Littlefinger, it's interesting to see the various. I mean, Littlefinger and Varys, it's a much more explicit scene. This is, I think. Well, I was going to say the least subtle of their interactions, but then there's the whole, like, chaos is in a pit, it's a ladder scene, which is even more heavy-handed. But they're just talking so explicitly about, I make my way this way, and you make your way this way, and this is how we survive at court, and how we scheme, and how we stay alive. And Pycelle's scene was sort of that, too. This is how Pycelle has survived through so many kings, right?
By coming off as helpless and very subservient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Pycelle is still on the small council, right?
Right.
You know, of all of them, like, Varys and Littlefinger basically fled Littlefinger to sort of amass more power, but they're gone, and Pycelle is still trucking along.
Yeah.
He had a low point for a while, but he's back, you know, so.
I would also argue that the scene is just, like, reiterating exposition that we've already gone through in the show, but that nonetheless is confusing. I mean, if you watch
King Aerys.
Yeah, King Aerys. I mean, if you watch an episode of 24, if you ever watch any 24, and I just give this as an example, every episode of 24 or even a show like Arrested Development, a massive quantity of time in those two shows as examples are spent reiterating things that have already happened in previous episodes. I think there's this rule, like, on network television, you can only expect people to watch one out of every four episodes of any given television show. This is like a few years ago, back before, you know, watching a Netflix
DVR. Yeah.
This is, I mean, not even that long ago, like 5 years ago, it would be difficult to expect people to follow a story like this closely. Sure, this is in the post-Sopranos age, but still, it's not nearly like serialized television is not nearly as prevalent as it is today, which is incredibly prevalent. But point being, I think it's just a way, like this Lyanna scene that they had earlier with Bran and this scene with Pycelle is just like, hey, this show has plot details that are difficult to grasp. Here is us reiterating them in various ways and from different perspectives.
So yeah, you can
kind of
understand
it. Yeah. But true, it also speaks a lot to Maester Pycelle's character. I agree with you as well. So, all right.
But we definitely did not need to see Roz naked for that to land, right?
And then not only that, but like the whole point of her being there, you know, she says, "What were you trying to say?" And he forgets what he was trying to tell her. The thing you must understand about kings, right? She just leaves.
But I'm not sure he forgets.
But I guess my point being, you know, it would be one thing to have her there naked if she actually had a purpose for being there and like some information on that. Like there was some kind of character development transaction going on, you know what I'm saying? But as it is, it seems like she was just there to be naked.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so that he, you know, she's part of the furniture for him to talk to.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, let's move on. We go to the Lannister camp, where Tywin is very upset that the Starks have his son.
Mm-hmm.
And Tywin essentially, so Tyrion says, like, hey, you're not going to be able to get peace, even though we're basically losing this war right now. You're not going to get peace because Joffrey cut off Ned's head. So we're all screwed. And Tywin is, like, very impressed by this tactical observation and sends him back to King's Landing as Hand of the King.
Yes.
And there is this line that he says about, like, what do you want me to do it? And he says, you're my son.
Yeah.
And in the book, this is imbued with even more significance because Tyrion interprets that as Tywin has basically written off Jaime's existence.
Yeah.
Like, he thinks Jaime is going to die, which Tyrion has not gotten to that point yet, not even close.
Right.
So
Tyrion loves Jaime. He's very loyal to Jaime. So the fact that he feels like his father has written Jaime off by acknowledging Tyrion as his son, that Tywin has written Jaime off, and that makes Tyrion outraged.
You were right about Eddard Stark. If he were alive, we could have used him to broker a peace with Winterfell and River Run. Which would have given us more time to deal with Robert's brothers. But now, madness. Madness and stupidity. I always thought you were a stunted fool. Perhaps I was wrong.
Half wrong? I'm new to strategy, but unless we want to be surrounded by three armies, it appears we can't stay here.
No one will stay here. Sir Gregor will head out with 500 riders and set a Riverland on fire from God's Eye to the Red Fork. The rest of us will regroup at Harrenhal. You will go to King's Landing.
And do what?
Rule. You will serve as Hand of the King in my stead. You'll bring that boy king to heel and his mother too, if needs be. And if you get so much as a whiff of treason from any of the rest, Baelish, Varys, Pycelle...
Head spikes walls. Why not my uncle? Why not anyone? Why me?
You're my son.
And then Tywin also demands that he not take Shae with him to court.
Right.
And then Tyrion says, hey, I'm taking Shae with me to court. This, again, is a scene that, like, later on, it's going to become especially ironic because when Tywin says, you're my son, I'm reemphasizing my bond with you. Of course, we know how Tywin dies. And then he says, you're not taking that person to court with you. And Tywin's the one that ends up betting Shae.
Yeah. I was thinking, you know, you did a sort of what if Sansa had pushed Joffrey off that bridge. I was watching this going, what if Tyrion just didn't take Shae with him? In the books, because he's so mad at Tywin, it's like Tywin's like, you're my son. So Tyrion's pissed because he feels like his father's written off Jaime. And then he says, you're not taking that whore to court with you. And so then Tyrion just goes back and goes, cool, I'm going to take her. Fuck you, Dad. In the show, it's more like Shay gets all affronted and then Tyrion decides to take her. So, I mean, it seems stupid because he just met her. So, like, why should he care that she's upset that she doesn't get to go to court? And so, yeah, I was watching that going, what if Tyrion just didn't take Shay to court with him? That would have been fine, you know?
Well, what would have – do you think then Tyrion would have been less pissed that Tywin was sleeping with her and then therefore Tyrion might not have killed Tywin?
Well, she wouldn't even have been there. But it wasn't just that. I mean, no. I think Tyrion would have killed Tywin anyway. But maybe. But she would have been there to testify against him in court. You know?
Right.
That's part of it. I don't know. There's a, I mean, the whole – Shay was a big weakness for Tyrion. And it's good for someone as smart as Tyrion to have such – such a weakness. That's good for
it's
storytelling.
Dramatic.
Yeah, yeah, for storytelling. But yeah, I was like, in the show version, watching Tyrion make that decision, because it's not clear that he's mad at Tywin. It seems like he's kind of pleased that Tywin is giving him some respect and credit. So it, you know, he does call his father the C word. So obviously, like, he still thinks his father's the worst, but I don't know. There's less of a direct line between that decision and what Tywin says about Jaime, or the way that Tyrion interprets it.
Tywin in the book also goes off on this massive rant about all the stupid things that Joffrey's been doing. You know, like he
dismissing Barristan,
making Janis Slynt a lord.
He has such a sick burn in the book about Janis Slynt because Janis Slynt's father was a butcher.
Yes.
So he's like, he picked a bloody spear as his sigil because he's been made a lord, so he gets to pick his own sigil. Picked a bloody spear. It should have been a bloody cleaver because he's a butcher. I was like, that's a Tywin zing. All right.
Yep. Okay. Agreed. That was a Tywin zing. But I also like, I don't know. I mean, this is what is part of the economy of the show, is that you see Joffrey cut this guy's tongue out, and that's all you really need to understand that Joffrey's a horrible king, right? You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah, but I think it's important to know that even his grandfather thinks that he's worse, which you get in this scene in the show because he says, what does he say? Madness and stupidity.
Right.
That's how he describes Joffrey's action. He doesn't need to do a laundry list. He can just say madness and stupidity. But I liked the part about Barristan that's in the book because it's nice that Tywin's like, I mean, you got to respect Barristan's name carries weight and honor. And it's important to respect that even if, you know, I don't personally like him. Like, that's smarter. It's smarter to keep Barristan around.
Right. Here's the line. Dismissing Selmy, where was the sense in that? Yes, the man was old, but the name of Barristan the Bold still has meaning in the realm. He lent honor to any man he served. Can anyone say the same of the Hound? Hound burn. You feed your dog's bone. I'm sorry. You feed your dog bones under the table. You do not seat him beside you on the high bench. Yeah. If Cersei cannot curb the boy, you must. So, end quote there. But yeah, there's good stuff in the book, basically, I think is...
You're saying people should read the book?
No, I'm not going that far. But I'm saying the book is pretty great. The show can still be enjoyed on its own terms.
Sure thing.
What else happens? So, yeah, he takes Shay with him, which would be a pretty consequential decision that would probably end up leading to his undoing in some ways.
And our first... moment with Tyrion in season 2 is him walking into King's Landing, right? Walking into Joffrey's birthday.
I don't recall, actually. It's been a while.
I think it's him like strolling into Joffrey's name day celebration.
That's right. Yeah, that sounds familiar. Yeah. Season 2 is the only season I haven't really gone back and revisited, but maybe I'll try after we do this rewatch.
Mm.
So just a couple more scenes to talk about. Firstly, let's talk about the wall. What's going on there? John basically, as you predicted last week, Jonah, John basically deserts his post, tries to go join Rob. Sam and his friends ride out after him, and they bring him back. In the book, they make Sam even more useless. Sam doesn't even go after him.
Yeah, but at least he doesn't like get knocked off his horse by a tree branch like he does in the show.
I'm not sure which one is more useless, to be honest with you. But anyway, they bring him back, and we find out from Sir Mormont that, hey, actually people run away all the time, but they come back usually, right?
But let's not blow past that great moment in the woods.
Yes.
With Sam and Pip and Gren all standing around John, the camera zooming around them as they say the words.
Yeah.
And thinking about how
the Gren, oath.
The great. Oath. And yeah. Then thinking about Gren saying that as he dies later, and Pip died the same night. There's no Ed yet. We don't get Ed till season two. But these are John's friends. Look how far he's come.
Yeah, it's pretty great. From them hating him earlier in the season, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure it's smooth sailing for John and the Night's Watch after this point. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. This is it. They're like, come back with us. And he's like, cool. And they lived happily ever after.
Agreed.
Uncle Benjen came back.
It was awesome. Well, so Sir Mormont there's a great line where he says, like, honor, you know, drove you from here. Honor brought you back. And John says, my friends brought me back. And Sir Mormont says, well, I didn't say it was your honor.
Right.
That's just an awesome line. And then Sir Mormont basically challenges him. He says, hey, we're going to go look for Benjen. We're going to fight through, you know, probably very dangerous ground. Are you going to play at being a person in the army, or are you going to be a member of the Night's Watch or something like that? And very effective. And you get the sense that it makes a great impression on John, who rides off north with everyone. Any other thoughts on John and the Night's Watch scenes this episode?
A couple things. I'm about to expose how dumb I am sometimes. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
So in the book, the penultimate chapter before Daenerys' final chapter is Robb and King of the North. King of the North, King of the North, King of the North is what you get right before you go to Daenerys. Here it's Jon, which I quite like. I think it's good. This epic riding into North of the Wall. And of course, that's where season two takes Jon. Like I said, this is all a big setup for season two. But as they were riding north, I was like, is this it? Is this how season one ended? Like, I just kind of forgot about Daenerys' big, like, one of the most famous moments in,
oh, wow,
in like all the TV. I was like, Jon rides north. The end, right? And it cuts to SS. So I was like, oh, no. Okay, no. All right. Stupid brain. Anyway, yeah.
Well, I'm glad you were able to be surprised by it yet again. Earlier in this episode.
Not surprised, but just, you know. I mean, it's interesting. It's, of course, they had to end with Daenerys stepping out of the flames. This is the big ender of the book as well. But it's interesting to see where they leave off with all these characters. You know, that they decided to put John right before Daenerys, you know? I don't know. I just think it's interesting.
Yeah, and a lot of the characters are basically like in motion, literally, right, at the end of the season.
Yeah.
So earlier on this episode, we found out that Dany miscarried, the baby did not live, and apparently the baby was all jacked up, according to the witch person, right?
Yeah, but she describes like a dragon. She says its skin was like scales and it had wings like a bat. That's a dragon, right?
Right.
It's interesting.
Yeah. So then they go. She's, you know, she wants to know what she's bought with her baby's life. They go out to see Khal Drogo, who is just in a complete catatonic state, and actually like way more catatonic on the show than he is in the book.
Yeah, because in the book he can walk.
Yeah, he can walk around. It, like, he seems like kind of like a guy who's like had a lobotomy. Whereas in the show, I don't even think he blinks this entire episode. Like, he's just like not even moving.
He's vegetative, yeah. No.
When Jorah says he seems to like the warmth, that just made me so sad because like basically this guy has been reduced down to expressing preference for temperatures, and that's all he can do at this point. And they have this great speech, this great talk where Dany starts to grow up real fast, Joanna, when what's her name? Mary
Missouri,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, like, hey, I'd already been raped several times before you saved me. They burned down my church. They killed all the people I loved.
The baker, come on.
The baker, this kid she'd healed, like all this stuff. And this awesome line that she has about, you know, like, she says, like, I saved your life. And she says, well, look at your call, like, now you'll see what good is life when everything else, like, has been taken away, when nothing else remains.
It's a great speech. It's, like, almost word for word from the book. And the actress, in her beautiful accent, does, like, an amazing job delivering it. It's really, really effective.
You knew what I was buying, and you knew the price.
It was wrong of them to burn my temple. It angered the great shepherd.
This is not God's work. My child was innocent.
Innocent? He would have been the stallion who mounts the world. Now he will burn no cities. Now his Khalasar will trample no nations into dust.
I spoke for you. I saved you.
Saved me? Three of those riders had already raped me before you saved me, girl. I saw my God's house burn. There, where I had healed men and women, beyond counting. In the streets, I saw piles of heads. The head of a baker who makes my bread. The head of a young boy that I had cured of fever just 3 months past. So, tell me again exactly what it was that you saved.
And it just, I think it kind of makes the world more morally complex for Dani. You know, she just thinks like, oh, I'm good. Other people are bad. You know, I'm going to save these women and therefore I'm good. But then it's like, well, actually, it's a little more complicated. Like, if you've spent a lot of time screwing over this person, he's not going to be particularly receptive to you.
And it's not a lesson I think Dani has even fully learned yet, right?
Yeah.
Because that's what kind of bites her, part of what bites her in this current season, this last, most recent season, is, you know, she's like, no, I saved you. Remember? Right. I liberated you. You love me. And they're like, do we? Yeah. So
what's great about this scene and this whole lesson is that despite all that, you know what she has learned and is still stuck with her? Vengeance. that is something that she has not let go of. And so she decides to burn not only Khal Drogo, but also this woman alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I gotta say, this section of the book was pretty transcendent. And I'm gonna read some passages from it. But first, I did like this line from the book that's not in the show that Jorah says to Dani. That like, there's a bunch of book stuff here that I felt like was really great and helped explain a lot of stuff. I understand why they cut it, but for instance, Jorah kind of tries to paint this whole life for the two of them. Come east with me, Yiti, Karth, the Jade Sea, Ashai by the Shadow. We will see all the wonders yet unseen and drink what wines the gods see fit to serve us. Please, Khaleesi, I know what you intend to do. Do not, end quote. That, I think, is the closest like Sir Jorah ever comes to like truly expressing his love for her, right? I mean, just basically like, look, our life together can be wonderful and idyllic.
No, he like tries to kiss her in the second book. I think it's the second book.
Maybe oh, well, I meant until this point, Joanna.
Oh, until this point, yes.
Yeah. It's just like, oh, yeah, like this is a far more explicit than show Jorah in terms of, like, it's very clearly he's, you know, pitching her on him at this point. Something else in the book that I also thought like the book did a much better job of was making clear how many people had left the Khalasar, which is apparently like tens of thousands down to about 100, right? And also why the remaining people would have stayed. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like she made made promises or she offered them stuff and they had loyalty. All that stuff was established in the book. You don't really need it because I don't even think about it, but I thought about it when I was watching this scene. Like what if the Dothraki only serve the strong or follow the strong, why are they still with this person if Khal Drogo is dead, right? That's all explained in the book as well.
Mm-hmm.
But did you have any other thoughts leading up to the final moments?
Well, I did really like, there's a whole long sequence, right, where she names three of the Dothraki as her, I think they're blood riders, by offering them these objects, as you say. And they're all like, no, you're a lady. We don't follow ladies. We like you, but we can't do this because it's not done. We'll escort you to the Dash Kaleen where you can retire, but we can't follow you. And then, of course, she has this great display of strength. And then they're intensely loyal to her.
Right.
So just to set up that dichotomy of, we like you, but you're a lady. We're not going to follow you. And then, oh, my God, you're a goddess. This is incredible, sort of thing.
So. Yeah, totally. So that was very good. And then she goes into the fire. And, you know, the book part of this was just ridiculously good, I thought, right? It was just so beautiful and so transcendent. I'm going to read a portion of it here. The heat beat at the air with great red wings, driving the Dothraki back, driving off even Mormont, but Dany stood her ground. She was the blood of the dragon, and the fire was in her. She had sensed the truth of it long ago, Dany thought, as she took a step closer to the conflagration. But the brazier had not been hot enough. The flames writhed before her, like the woman who had danced at her wedding, whirling and singing and spinning their yellow and orange and crimson veils, fearsome to behold, yet lovely, so lovely, alive with heat. Dany opened her arms to them, her skin flushed and glowing. This is a wedding too, she thought, end quote. That's just awesome, right?
Yes.
I just thought that's like amazing writing. There is a portion of the book where like her like milk starts flowing out of her breasts because she just had a child recently. I did think that that was a good move to not include that in the show. That would have been over the top, I think.
Yeah, but the dragons are like suckling at her breasts when she emerges, and that's a great image.
Yeah.
Breastfeeding is natural. It's great. it is. Oh, well, the detail that I liked in the book was you hear the eggs cracking, but you don't know that that's what you're hearing if you're just reading it for the first time. She hears the first crack of a stone, you know, and you think maybe it's just the pyre collapsing, and then there's a second one, and then there's just a huge third one, which I'm guessing is Drogon coming out. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and as she stands up and in the show, the camera kind of spins around her, you see everyone just bowing down. And honestly, if that happened in today's age, like that might be my reaction too. You know, if this woman emerged naked from this fire with these dragons that haven't been seen in hundreds of years, like I would probably feel like I was in the presence of something holy and beyond my comprehension as well. So incredible scene, very convincingly played. And then with the dragon crying out to end the episode, cut to black, it made me really excited for the next season of this show. Any other thoughts we want to say about this specific scene before we reflect on the season, Joanna?
Yes, I have a very important thing to say. This is my first encounter with someone on the internet having a disproportionate reaction to a Game of Thrones spoiler. Which is that it was like 3 days after the episode aired, I wrote a post on Pajiba.com, my former home, about, I don't know, it was like the most ridiculous objects TV shows have used to cover a naked body. and obviously, like, you see Emilia Clarke's breast, but you never see, like, her pubic region because she's holding a dragon in front of it.
Correct.
Which I just thought was hilarious. And the header image I used was her, like, sooty. I mean, it's a famous image now of her sooty and with the dragon on her shoulder. But someone hadn't seen the episode. It was, like, 3 days after it aired. Didn't know that there were dragons that were coming at all. And just lost it at me and called me, like, the nastiest words I've ever been called, probably, on the internet. So that's when I learned you got to be careful with Game of Thrones spoilers.
Well, Joan, I'm really sorry that happened to you. That's unacceptable in general. But I will say that, it's not that you got to be careful with Game of Thrones spoilers. You got to be careful with putting Game of Thrones spoilers in things that people cannot avoid.
Right. The header image.
The header image or the headline. And, you know, to be fair, you have gotten very good at that. I've seen all your Vanity Fair stuff. It is very respectful to book readers, probably because you do this podcast with me. And you know, if you didn't do it, I would give you a ton of shit on the show. I think you've done a great job on the podcast and elsewhere. So
thank you.
Anyway, any other thoughts on the scene?
No.
Yeah.
Just wanted to share that I think of that every time I see that photo. So
nice.
Just wanted to share it.
Good. Good. And you're like, now this person wouldn't give me a difficult time. But back then, it was a huge deal. There probably are still people who'd give you a difficult time for that. But anyway, so
I guess, but like now that like a gif of that, I mean, it's really only been a couple years, right? But a gif of that image, like that image would have been like,
5 years.
Yeah, but like not that long really. And the internet has changed so much. Like, I know you haven't watched it yet, so I won't spoil it all, but there was this huge thing that happened on Fargo this week. And the minute after the episode aired, huge outlets like Entertainment Weekly, New York Times, like if it were the equivalent of this episode, they would have been like, holy shit, dragons in their tweet like headline.
Right.
New York Times. I was like, come on, guys. Like, be creative, allude to it, and then people have seen it will click, and then you can go, holy shit, dragons, or the equivalent within, you know? And yeah, that drives me crazy. I mean, I'm sure I'm guilty of it. I'm sure I am. I know people have yelled at me. I'm sure that I've slipped up. But it's just the, I mean, the slippery slope of what's going on nowadays. Because people are just so thirsty for clicks.
Yeah.
And I understand that's how I get paid too. So I get it. But it's just, yeah. Anyway.
It's a tough world out there. Tough world,
I mean, there. Really, let's put my problems in perspective and move along.
So let's talk about two things. Firstly, overall reflections on the season. And then secondly, any major plot lines they left out of the show that were in the book that we feel like, oh man, not necessarily they should have included that because I feel like they packed about as much as they could have in the show. But, you know, is there something that we're like, oh, I kind of missed that, you know, or I felt that would have really helped characters or plot lines. But let's start with overall thoughts on the season. This still is my favorite season of Game of Thrones. I mean, just the whole subversion of the Ned plotline and our expectations of that still remains brilliant to me. A lot of the writing is super sharp. Many chunks of it come straight from the book. And they just created this whole world out of nothing. And that just remains incredibly impressive to me. So for all those reasons, I think this is still my favorite season of the show. And I'm really glad we did this. Your thoughts on season one, Joanna?
Yeah, I think it benefits from being really loyal to the book, honestly. And I think that's because this is one of the books that is actually adaptable into a season of television. Right. And I think the later books are not. So, you know, it's not like they got cocky and just decided they didn't need the books. The later ones are harder. The second book is okay. But, you know, the prose that they just pull directly from the book and put in the show, it works beautifully. And to answer your second question, I can't even think of something that I just think it's glaring that they left out. I guess the only thing would be the Tullys, like more of the Tullys. But maybe I'm forgetting something bigger. But
well, the one thing that I think the show really could have done a better job with this season, with the benefit of later seasons, knowing what happens, is the Mountain and the whole Clegane family and their situation. Because, you know, he's just basically a monster in season five. And there's a whole rich backstory to the Clegane's relationship with each other. And you know, they used a different actor in season one. And so, and you only see him for like one episode, but really the Clegane's are doing all these horrible things. Like, literally, is it Gregor Clegane, right?
Yeah.
Who's the Mountain?
Mm-hmm.
He is partially responsible for all the people swearing fealty to Robb Stark,
right?
Because he's been pillaging all their villages and so on,
marauding. Yeah.
So I just felt like, oh man, there was a lot there that probably without much work, without much character work, they could have like established his character better. And then therefore had his return in this most recent season or the most recent couple seasons be more impactful. So that was the only one that was particularly glaring.
No, I think that's a good point. It's just making a big assumption. But I wonder if they cast the Mountain and they're like, okay, this guy is physically impressive, but not a tremendously good performer. None of the Mountains, I think, have been tremendously great. The most recent one is a very impressive physical specimen, but
and yeah. He knows how to make viral videos as well.
Yeah, he does, but he's not like a great performer. I don't know. Maybe that's unfair. I think he's the best of the three. But the one they cast in season two is kind of this weird, like, string banging. Like, he was tall and a better performer, but not as physically imposing. And, yeah, I think you're right. The mountain has been a problem throughout. If they had cast someone great in the beginning and made him more of a presence, all of this would have been landed a little better.
Maybe they literally didn't even know that he would be a major character later at the time. Right? Because the most recent book wasn't written by then, right?
Oberyn dies in the third book. So that was definitely.
Oh, wow. Okay, wow. So he dies. Like he dies in season four of the show, right?
Yeah.
But book three. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Book three is quite long and was actually originally released in two volumes in the UK. So it was split sort of over season three and four. That's part of like when the adaptation got really messy, is having to split the huge Storm of Swords books. Book.
Other than that, the only things that stick out to me are like Kat is a much better well-rounded character in the book than she is in the show.
Much more sympathetic, I think.
Yeah, and there's much less sex position in the book than there is in the show.
Yes, though someone on Tumblr did an exhaustive, detailed exploration of all the rapes in the book and all the rapes in the show. And, you know, including minor characters, right? And so it turns out the books are far, far, far rapier than the show. So it's interesting.
Huh. All right. Well, on that note.
No, let's not end on that note.
any other thoughts on the book versus the show? Okay, let's ask this. So what are you – can you say what you're looking forward to next season? Is there a plot line that you're particularly keen on finding out the resolution to next season?
This feels like a trap. What can I say? There's some stuff in this book in next season that I think is going to be very fun.
Hmm. So stuff that I've already read, theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. All right.
Well. But we didn't talk about it too much, so intentionally.
I'm intrigued, Joanna. I'm very intrigued.
That's my most delightful hint that I can drop.
All right. Yes. All right.
Any casting? Oh, I mean, you know about some of the actors who are in next season, right?
Some, but I try to stay away from that news. So probably not, actually, is the answer to your question.
Really? Not even the big names? No?
No. I got nothing.
Wow.
I got nothing.
All right. I'm shutting up.
All right. I appreciate that. So in terms of next season of Game of Thrones, is there going to be a Cast of Kings recap? I would say the answer is most likely yes. I can't see any reason why not. I'm not sure how we will fund it yet, whether it's going to be Kickstarter or sponsors or both. But subscribe to this feed and tune in a couple weeks before the next season begins, and you should see new episodes pop up prepping us for the next season. And I think that's about it. Anything else we want to say, or shall we wrap it up there for a few months?
That's it until 2016.
Thanks for listening to us, and hope you guys had a fun time rewatching and rereading season one of Game of Thrones. And hope you will patronize the lovely sponsors we had this season that helped make this show possible. And yeah, thanks so much. Again, always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Find more of our episodes at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/acastofkings. And we will see you guys for season 6 of Game of Thrones.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra durable pocket hose copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.